listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, get the latest news from around the world in the Friday News Roundup. That's today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, making new friends can be really hard, especially as a grown-up. And keeping up existing friendships as life changes can be a big challenge, too. Our next guest says the science of attachment can teach us a lot about our own strengths and weaknesses as friends and what we look for in friendships. She's also got advice to help make it easier to find new friends and to be a good friend to the ones you've already got. We're listening back to this conversation, and we want to hear from you. Is there a friendship in your life that's really important to you? What works for you maintaining close friendships in your own life? Is making new friends exciting, terrifying, all of the above? Email ideas@wpr.org. Marissa G. Franco is an assistant clinical professor of university honors at the University of Maryland. She's the author of the book Platonic: How the Science of Attachment Can Help You Make and Keep Friends. I talked to her earlier this year. Now, you opened the book with a personal moment for you, a romantic relationship ended, and tell us how important your friends were in rising up from that moment.
Yeah, so to heal from that at the time, I decided to start this wellness group with my friends where we would meditate, cook, do yoga together, and I just really felt the love from all of them. And it led me to question some ideas that I had about love, that romantic love was the only love that counted, the only love that made me worthy, that, you know, proved my value. And so I started to wonder, why doesn't platonic love matter? Like, why hasn't it mattered to me that I'm loved by all of these people? Why have I treated it like this is secondary and illegitimate and romantic love is the only legitimate form of connection? So I sort of went on a quest to level this hierarchy of love that I think hurts people who are within and outside of romantic relationships because it makes us really devalue friendship. And so that's part of the reason that I decided to write Platonic.
I think we all might know, yeah, having friends, that's a good thing. Nothing wrong with that. You really lay out how important friends can be and having those connections. What are some of the benefits of having good friendships?
Yeah. So loneliness is as toxic for our bodies as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. And you might think, okay, but I can cure my loneliness through my spouse or my family, right? But there's actually three types of loneliness, only one in which can be met through a spouse, which is intimate loneliness, the desire for someone to have a very close connection with, like you have with a spouse or a best friend. But there's also relational loneliness. We have a desire for people that are about as close to us as a friend. And then collective loneliness, which is the desire for being part of a group that's working towards a common goal. And any of these forms of loneliness can be at play, such that even if we're very happy with our spouse, we can still end up feeling lonely because basically this suggests that we've always needed an entire community to feel truly whole.
And you share some of the numbers there. We Americans are kind of bad at this. Our numbers of friends, our friend networks are going down from year to year. What do you think is driving that?
Oh, man, so many different factors. You know, it really started with the creation of the television in the 1950s. And before then, leisure was a public affair that people did with their friends when they had free time. They just spent it with other people. But then people just started to spend their free time in front of the television. And in 2012, we also see spikes in loneliness. And that's around the time when the smartphone really became popular. And of course, there's ways to use technology to foster connection. But what it does is it has opportunity costs, right? That if we're using this technology every day for entertainment, to pass the time, we're not hanging out, which is what we would do if we were maybe more bored and didn't have this low-hanging fruit that gives us almost a snack of connection, parasocial connections. We feel connected to people we don't even know. And the snack makes us not realize just how hungry we are for the full meal of connection, the in-person interaction.
We're talking to Marissa G. Franco about her new book. It's called Platonic: How the Science of Attachment Can Help You Make and Keep Friends. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has friendship been an important thing in your life? Do you have a friend you want to talk about with us? Or has it been a challenge for you, maybe as you age? Spend more time with your family. Is it harder to make and keep friendships? Or have you moved someplace new? What worked? What didn't work with making new friends? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Marissa, let's get to work. In that situation, somebody's thinking, yeah, gosh, I want more friends. But you don't want to just walk up to another grown-up and say, will you be my friend? How do we get started?
Yeah, the first thing is we have to let go of the idea that friendship happens organically. Mm-hmm. As adults, it does not. As kids, we have these ingredients, continuous unplanned interaction and shared vulnerability. We see people every day. We let our guard down through gym, recess, right? And that's what fosters organic connection. As adults, we no longer are inhabiting settings like that, right? At work, we see people every day, but we usually are not particularly vulnerable with our colleagues. So that means that you can't rely on friendship happening organically. In fact, doing so is related to being more lonely over time, and you're going to have to initiate. Now, people are very afraid of initiating, but I like to share with people, the research actually finds people are less likely to reject you than you think. There's research on a phenomenon called the liking gap, wherein when strangers interact and are asked to predict, how much do you think the other person likes you? We tend to underestimate just how liked we are. The more self-critical we are, the more pronounced this underestimation. So I suggest assume people like you because according to other research on something called the acceptance prophecy, when people are told that they'll go into a group and be liked based on their personality profile, and even if this is a lie, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy because it makes people warmer, friendlier, more engaged.
On a practical level, so we know somebody at work or a friend of a friend or whatever, what are some ways to build that relationship in a friendshiply direction?
Yeah, so right, I talked about the problem at work being that we only show one dimension of us. A great way to bring out multiple dimensions of us is something called repotting, which was created by Ryan Hubbard at the Kite String Project. And that's the idea of varying the settings in which we interact, right? So stop interacting at work, stop talking about work, like share who you are as a real person, say to them like, oh, it's been so nice to like get to know you at work. Like, would you want to go for a walk after work? Or, you know, I was going to go to the museum this weekend. Would you be up for that? Right. And that also makes the friendship more sustainable. People complain, well, when the work is over, we no longer see each other. But once you have precedent for seeing each other, even when you're not in the working hours, it's going to be easier to maintain it if there's transitions as well.
Now, you write about the psychology of our attachment styles. What is an attachment style and how does it affect our friendship journeys?
Yeah, great question. So attachment style is basically a template we have for how people will treat us that we create in childhood and update throughout life. And this template we have, this expectation for how other people will treat us, is ridden with confirmation bias, such that we see in the world things that match our expectation and discount experiences that don't match it. So there's three major attachment styles. Secure people. Their template is people are trustworthy. They'll love me. They'll accept me. And that means they behave in ways that reflect this template. They are open, vulnerable, better at initiating friendships, less likely to end friendships, according to the research. They move away from people that aren't nice and aren't friendly. They're just very comfortable with themselves. They assume people like them, right? Versus anxiously attached people whose template is people are going to abandon you. So how do they navigate friendships because of that? They move very quickly, are sort of like overshare from the beginning, tend to have these very fragile friendships. They assume they're being rejected even when they're not. And then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy because then they try to reject because they think they're rejected. And they sort of manifest their greatest fears because of that. And then you have avoidantly attached people who are also afraid of abandonment and fundamentally think others are untrustworthy. So how do they handle these fears? The avoidantly attached people, they keep to themselves. They're the lone wolves. They're never vulnerable. They're not really trying in their friendships. They end up ghosting more than other attachment styles. People feel like I'm around him, but I don't actually know him because he never actually shares anything about himself. They suppress their emotions. They're very uncomfortable with anyone else's emotions. So conflict is a big fear of them. They can be sort of people pleasing so they don't have to face some emotions in others.
We're talking to psychologist Marissa G. Franco about her new book, Platonic, How the Science of Attachment Can Help You Make and Keep Friends. We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. Kind of surprised. I guess we don't have friends in Wisconsin. Do you have a story of friendship you want to share with us? Do you need some advice from our guest on maybe making a friendship or maintaining past friendships? Love to hear from you. If you have a question, a thought, an experience you would like to share about making or maybe losing friends along the way, Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Marissa G. Franco about her new book. It's called Platonic, How the Science of Attachment Can Help You Make and Keep Friends. You can join in with your story of friendship, maybe a tough time in your life where you've had trouble making friends, maybe after moving or moving to a new job, say. What's worked for you? What doesn't? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Elizabeth is with us in Madison. Elizabeth, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm known for keeping in touch with my friends. They always talk about how great I am about doing that. I have friends from 30, 40, 45 years back that I've kept in touch with. And I think that friendship, it does take work or effort to be able to keep in touch with people and, you know, keep up with their addresses or emails or new phone numbers, but it's really worth it. And I just think that was the important point I wanted to make.
I love it, Elizabeth. I'll tell you, you're a better friend than I am and probably a better person too, Marissa. I'm the opposite of Elizabeth. I'm famously abysmal at keeping in touch with people, and I'm one of those people who gets, you know, I feel guilty, and I'm like, oh, it's too late. I can't, you know, I feel like an idiot if I reach out. How do we be more like Elizabeth than like me?
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's lovely that you have positive intent, and Elizabeth, I'm glad that you are able to do all of those things because I'm sure you're making other people feel so, so loved. I think part of the ways we get better at it is we change our framework for friendship. I think a lot of us have this frame of friends. It's good vibes only. It's easy. It's not that. And so it's not on our list of priorities, right? Because of how we've just been socialized and conditioned to see it. But in fact, I argue that there's a difference between good company and a good friend. That good company is someone whose time you enjoy. They put you in a good mood, right? You like them as a person. But that is not a good friend. To be a good friend, it's a responsibility, an investment, a commitment in another person, right? It's, I'm going to be there to support you in your times of need. I'm going to try to make you feel safe when you're vulnerable. When you succeed, I'm going to celebrate you, right? I think our framework for friends needs to be more similar to our framework for romance, which is I need to put in time and effort. And there's times where this is going to be hard, but I also know that it's really worth it. And so it's really making friendship a priority amidst all of our other priorities.
Thanks again for that call, Elizabeth, at 800-642-1234. Paul joins us next in Northern Illinois. Paul, hi.
Hey, how's it going, Rob? I love your show. You know it.
Thanks.
I had to laugh when I was listening. I heard this. Hi, my name is Paul. Will you be my friend? And actually, that's how my wife describes me. And I guess I'm trying to understand, is there a potential to have a combination of these friendships? In other words, I have friends that I consistently meet up with and we go through the deeper deeps. And then I have wonderful companions like a girl that I met in an airplane that took me all around, a Caribbean island because we just happened to talk on the plane. Wow. Together with my wife. I'm just curious, are there gray lines?
Paul, I think I gotcha. We can have a variety of friends, maybe Marissa, with a variety of roles in our lives.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a great question. And, you know, I think that's the beauty of friendship, that it can occur on such a spectrum, right? Like now some people are even choosing friends for their life partners, but we also have these sort of friendly acquaintances. I also talk about in the book this idea of low-dose friends, right? There's some people that we like some parts of them, we don't like others, and you might think, oh, this person can't be my friend, but in fact, you could really enjoy their company at low doses. If you see them once a month, you're like, oh, I'm happy, that was nice, but if you see them more frequently, it's like, oh, no. And so that's the beauty of friendship. We can sort of turn the dial down or turn the dial up based off of the connection we have, the degree of compatibility that we feel. And so it can just give us so much versatility.
Paul, thanks a lot for sharing that with us at 800-642-1234. Talking to Marissa G. Franco. Her new book is called Platonic, How the Science of Attachment Can Help You Make and Keep Friends. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Matt is with us in Wonder Lake, Illinois. Matt, hi.
Hi. Love WPR. Love the Ideas Network. I just wanted to comment really quick. You know, I was a millennial in Chicago, went to art school, had a number of bands, a couple of my bands toured the world, and we had incredible experiences together. However, like after the pandemic, we all seemed to go our separate ways, and it's been, really, really tough reestablishing some sort of connection with my former bandmates and the people that I was so close to making art with. And I just wanted to speak on that. And, you know, I really try to make an effort, and, you know, when those efforts aren't reciprocated, it can be kind of hurtful. So I just wanted to speak on that and just say, you know, continue to reach out to your good friends, and hopefully one day you'll be able to hang out with them in the same capacity again. So thank you.
Matt, thanks a lot for that call. Marissa, I'm guessing Matt is very much not alone in that, you know, pandemic disruption of the life with friends. Do you have some advice for him and other people in that situation trying to rebuild?
Yeah, well, Matt, I really love your investment in your previous friendships. I think more generally, we saw in the pandemic a sort of split in how friendship was affected, right? For those people that your friendship is a companionate friendship, it's contingent on you doing activities together, it was a real blow. We couldn't do activities together. But for those people whose friendship was founded on sharing the deep, vulnerable, profound stuff, right? Reaching out when we're struggling and getting support, those friendships were a little bit more durable because we all needed support. So, hey, we were able to access them. It looks like this caller is sort of struggling because he's still invested in these friendships and his friends aren't. I think just some follow-up questions I have to ask is that, you know, we tend to devalue our friendships more if we don't see them in person. So have you tried to see these friends in person so they can sort of recognize your chemistry and your dynamic and how much they value you, right? That when we're apart from people, it's hard for us to viscerally feel that connection in the same way than when we're in person. I think it's also helpful to think about friendship as flexible, not fragile. What I mean by that is friendships ebb and flow, right? And if you're in an ebb and you assume it's fragile, then you're going to assume it's over and you're not going to reach out anymore. But it might be that this is going to flow again at another time when, you know, your friends are in a good place. So you can sort of treat it that way. That being said, I hear that it hurts when the relationships don't feel so reciprocal and you're the only one reaching out. And I also wanted to say, it'll be important to find relationships that are reciprocal, right? To find those people that are ready and available. And we tend to find those in transitioners. That's people who just moved to a city, who are going through a divorce or breakup, who just retired. They tend to be particularly open to friendship. So I think that's a good place to start.
Thanks for that call. Good luck. Hope that helps. Time for one more caller. Kimberly is with us in Arena. Kimberly, hi.
Hi. So I tend to be the extroverted friend. I'm the one that's always taking my crew of introverted friends along with me because I'm making all of the decisions or, hey, let's all go out here tonight. And I've just been kind of experiencing a lot of decision fatigue from that lately, and so then I end up staying home because I don't want to go out and make decisions or make everybody go someplace, so then everybody else ends up staying home.
Wow.
And I just keep going through the same cycles because then I'll be tired, we won't do anything, and then go right back to it, and we just can't seem to find a balance. I don't know.
Interesting. Kimberly, thanks for the call. Marissa, briefly, do you have advice for Kimberly to have some of those introverts get on board and organize it and make some of the decisions?
Yeah, Kimberly, I think maybe trying to automate your hangouts, like every other Wednesday we're going to go to this restaurant or every other Wednesday we're going to choose to go to someone's house can be a really great way to do it. The other thing I wonder is if you've made your expectations, if you have asserted them in an upfront way, right? Or if you're just sort of upset about this and hoping someone will kind of get the hint. And I think just saying something as simple as like, hey, y'all, really want to see y'all. Coordinating, being the coordinator can sometimes be hard on me. Would we be open to sort of rotating who sets up our plans and see what they say?
Good luck, Kimberly. In just our last minute or so, Marissa, rescuing the word love. I think we just think of romantic love in our society now. Make the case for thinking of love as something we have for our friends.
So there's this Italian philosopher who says platonic love is a love so beautiful that it transcends the physical. And so I think we can see that each love is beautiful. Romantic love is beautiful, but platonic love is beautiful too. And it, in its non-sexual nature, right, it provides us with its own offerings in its fluidity. It provides us with its own offerings and its versatility, right? In the fact that our friends can be an entire community, whereas for most of us, our spouse is limited to one person. It provides us with unique offerings, which make it so that friendships cannot be replaced by any other type of relationship.
Marissa, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Marissa G. Franco, psychologist with the University of Maryland. We talked about her book, Platonic, How the Science of Attachment Can Help You Make and Keep Friends. She joined the show earlier this year. We just listened back to it, but love to hear from you if you would like to give a shout out to a friendship, current, past, or one you're hoping for in the future. Let us know about it. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. If you have a secret to maintaining long-term friendships, tell us about that too. Again, email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, the United States is still trying to figure out how to commemorate slavery and segregation in American history. We'll find out why Germany could offer some lessons. We know which party is going to control each chamber of Congress now, with a narrow majority on each side, Democrats in the Senate, Republicans in the House. We'll look at changes in leadership and what might and might not happen with divided chambers of Congress in the years to come. And we humans and our primate cousins have a lot of similarities in our brains, plus some big differences, too. A Wisconsin researcher joins the show to share the latest brain science in our part of the animal family tree. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time. That's coming up on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's Food Friday, and our guest has lots of pasta advice. She'll walk us through how to make our own homemade noodles and sauces, plus great recipes with pasta, homemade or store-bought. First, we're answering two listener questions that came in through WPR's Wisconsin Project about attitudes toward abortion in the 19th century. An anonymous listener from Juneau County asked, what in our society has changed since 1849? What did people in Wisconsin in those times feel that human life at all stages should be protected by law? And Jill from Madison asked, is there any record on how that law was enforced prior to Roe v. Wade in 1972? The way people felt about abortion in the 19th century was complicated, sometimes divided, just like today. There was no one way people thought about it, just like today. But competing narratives about that history can make it even more difficult to understand. For example, in his draft decision overturning Roe v. Wade, Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito writes that abortion bans passed in the mid-1800s, like Wisconsin's, were, quote, spurred by a sincere belief that abortion kills a human being, end quote. Some historians dispute that idea and say that the laws were pushed by the medical profession's desire to take control from midwives, among other reasons. We're talking about attitudes toward abortion in the 19th century here in Wisconsin and around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the history of abortion and abortion laws? What have you heard about the way people used to think about the issue? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Mary Ziegler is professor at the University of California Davis School of Law, a leading authority on the history of the abortion debate in the U.S. Her latest book is Dollars for Life, the Anti-Abortion Movement, and the Fall of the Republican Establishment. Mary, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
And Kimberly Riley is an associate professor of democracy and justice studies and history, chair of the history program, and co-chair of the Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies program at UW Green Bay. Kim, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start with that first listener question, Kim. Can you talk about what people in Wisconsin, the variety of ways people in Wisconsin might have thought about abortion in the mid-1800s when this law came into effect?
Sure. Well, I mean, what we know about the law that was passed in 1849 is that it actually made the killing of a quick child an act of manslaughter. And I think it's important for folks to understand what that phrase quick child meant. What that meant was a child that had undergone quickening. And quickening was the feeling of fetal movement that a pregnant woman would feel, which takes place between usually the fourth and sixth month of pregnancy. And so stretching back from the 13th century all the way up through the mid 19th century, 13th century in Europe, mid 19th in the United States, the quickening doctrine prevailed in law. And what that meant was that it was acceptable to end a pregnancy before quickening was felt. So I would say that in Wisconsin, there were many people who would have, imagined that restoration of your menstruation or a kind of they used the language of unblocking in the mid-19th century, which effectively was abortion, would have seen that as perfectly acceptable before, maybe even the 6 month of pregnancy.
And Mary, that law gets revised 9 years later, 1858, taking out the word quick. Was this a common debate, a common system of changes around the country to go from that banning abortion after the quickening, as Kim was just saying, and narrowing that down?
It was. There was a movement led by the American Medical Association that took issue with this quickening distinction across the country and, seemed to have unsurprisingly complicated motives for a social movement of this kind. But the American Medical Association was pushing that kind of proposal, not just in Wisconsin, but in states across the country, was even pushing it, with the president of the United States in Congress. So this was definitely a national transformation, not just a local one.
Now, Kim, Wisconsin becomes a state in 1848, the first abortion law you're talking about passed in 1849. Was this, a specific thing saying, hey, we have to tackle this abortion issue, or is this just something that Wisconsin did as it was becoming a state?
Well, we don't know precisely. We know that they're trying to codify the common law, and that's something that's happening also in some states during the mid-19th century. There's an effort made by some legal reformers to kind of rationalize and make, common laws judicial decisions. And so if you put something into statute, you potentially make it more predictable, you create more sort of rational ways of entry in terms of procedures that lawyers would have to undergo to bring cases. So I think this is, likely a matter of the state taking the common law. They're not really changing the common law. They're just sort of putting it into statute, as the state is becoming a state.
And Mary, law and common law is one thing. Actual practice, and you were starting to touch on this, was another. What was the landscape like when it came to terminating early pregnancies in the mid-1800s?
Well, we know that one of the reasons that there was this national movement to criminalize abortion was because there was a perception that abortion was increasingly common, especially in urban communities, although not exclusively in those communities. And we know, too, that once states began criminalizing abortion earlier in pregnancy, as Wisconsin did, prosecutions remained pretty unusual, with the exception of cases where, a pregnant woman died during the procedure too. So even as Wisconsin was sort of joining other states and passing further reaching abortion bans, there was a pretty big, I think, disjuncture between the letter of the law and how people were living their lives.
We are answering why Wisconsin questions about attitudes toward abortion and laws and enforcement of laws on abortion. Not now, not in this last century, but in the mid-1800s, when these laws first came into effect. They're now back into effect, effectively in the state. You could join in with your questions about that history at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. With us are Mary Ziegler, University of California Davis law professor, and Kim Riley, associate professor at UW Green Bay. Kim, there was a key figure here in Wisconsin connected to the national scene, William Henry Brisbane, a doctor on the American Medical Association committee that reported on criminal abortion. Can you talk about his influence here in the state at the time?
Sure. I would say we don't have a complete historical record on Dr. Brisbane, but from the information we do have, we know he was a Baptist minister that was born in South Carolina. And he moved to Wisconsin in the 1850s, and he became chief clerk of the state Senate in 1857. And As you say, he was appointed by the American Medical Association to report on its efforts to criminalize and suppress abortion. And he, in some letters that he wrote to colleagues, he expressed fears about particularly middle class and upper class women seeking abortions and even using birth control. And he wrote to a colleague that he wanted to get a law passed that criminalized both birth control and abortion in Wisconsin. And so, of course, you know, the law did not include birth control, but you know, that so it's likely that he had a kind of influence over this 1858 law. And he wrote in another letter to a colleague that he didn't actually expect the law to be enforced, but he hoped that it would have a moral influence over people. So I think even he was pragmatic about, you know, as Professor Ziegler saying, the realities of enforcement of these anti-abortion, criminalization of abortion laws.
And Mary Kim takes us to our second listener question there about enforcement of these abortion laws. What did that look like after states like Wisconsin passed abortion laws, whether it was after Quickening or in 1858 across the board?
There was a lot of under enforcement. So again, we don't have complete data, but by some estimates from the 19th century, abortion rates were actually climbing after the passage of these criminal laws. And prosecutions, notwithstanding that fact, seem to be very rare unless a pregnant patient died. And so you had this kind of odd sort of dual mindset that appeared to exist because you had lots of states like Wisconsin, passing abortion laws, maybe seemingly eliminating the Quickening distinction, and simultaneously people's actual experience with abortion, their willingness to have abortions, perform abortions, didn't seem fundamentally different. And in fact, prosecutors were very unlikely to enforce the laws. So I think that's one of the reasons it's hard to kind of generalize about whether this was an era when attitudes about abortion were different in some ways from ours, because there was no single attitude I think we can identify.
We're talking about attitudes toward abortion in the 19th century when Wisconsin and many other states passed, in some cases, their first laws banning abortion in some or all instances. Our guests are Mary Ziegler, professor at the University of California Davis School of Law, and Kim Riley, associate professor of Democracy and Justice Studies, History and Women's Studies at UW Green Bay. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question about this history. That's 800-642-1234. The conversation continues coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about the history of abortion and attitudes toward abortion when laws were passed in the mid-1800s. Our guests are Kim Riley, Associate Professor of Democracy and Justice Studies, History and Women's Studies at UW Green Bay, and Mary Ziegler, Professor at the University of California Davis School of Law. These come from questions through our Wisconsin project about attitudes toward abortion in the 1800s and enforcement of those laws. And Mary, our questioners are really on the right track here, I think, because these historical issues, and you've written about this, they were cited in the original Roe v. Wade decision, and they were cited in the Dobbs decision this year. Can you talk about how important different views of this history have been in setting laws at the U.S. Supreme Court?
Absolutely, yeah. So I think for the Roe Court, the history was relevant to show that there was no kind of longstanding tradition of opposition to abortion. The Roe Court ultimately wasn't focusing entirely on history and tradition and reaching an outcome. It was instead saying, you know, primarily that the right to privacy, right, a right that encompassed other decisions that were life-changing, like the ability to use contraception or to marry or to decide with whom you lived or to raise children or to procreate, was a similar right. But Justice Blackmun, the author of Roe, spent a lot of time saying that there was no kind of unbroken tradition of opposition to abortion. And he looked at some of this 19th century history and said, well, you know, at the time before that, abortion wasn't widely criminalized. Even after that, attitudes seemed to have been more complicated. And he also emphasized that, in his view, attitudes had changed, right? So there had been more support for abortion in recent years, which he considered to be constitutionally significant. The Supreme Court this summer in the Dobbs case took a different approach to history. I think one saying the only thing that matters historically or really constitutionally either is what happened in the 19th century. It doesn't matter if people's attitudes have changed since then, or if, you know, the world has changed such that, you know, women can vote now and couldn't vote then, among other things. What matters is what happened at the time the relevant part of the Constitution was written. And Alito took a view, I think that's, it's fair to say, is a minority view in the academy, but there are some scholars who think this, that abortion had always been criminally, either criminal or at least widely viewed as immoral throughout pregnancy and certainly criminalized after quickening. And that if that was true, there could be no abortion right, essentially. People who would have criminalized abortion would not have thought that abortion was a constitutional right. So that history has been pretty high stakes from the beginning. And I think especially now when we have a Supreme Court that says that whether we have rights or not on a particular subject depends entirely on what the court believes the framers of the Constitution believed at a specific moment in the past.
We got a call from Carol in Appleton who couldn't stay on the line. Carol wants to know about the 1985 Wisconsin abortion law, wondering why it hasn't superseded the 1849 law. So this was a law passed under Roe v. Wade, changing the law. Someone in Wisconsin is the subject of active lawsuits in Wisconsin now. Kim, why hasn't that 1985 law effectively superseded what was in place in 1858?
You know, honestly, I'm sure Mary could do a better job than I could at answering that question. But my understanding is that it's, as you say, currently kind of winding its way through the courts and potentially serving as a challenge to the 1849/1858 law.
Mary, do you have you been following Wisconsin that closely?
I think there's a question about the ban. Obviously, is the older ban is much older. The challenges, I think, tend to be whether these laws can automatically, and I'm trying to simplify this, come back into effect once Roe is gone. I think the argument that folks make that isn't possible, or that it would not be superseded by the 1985 law, is essentially that, you know, holding a law like the earlier Wisconsin ban unconstitutional doesn't erase it from the statute books. It just sort of leaves it there like a zombie waiting around. And then as soon as Roe v. Wade is gone, in theory, that would resurrect the law. And it would then add to the prohibitions in the 1985 law, which my understanding is kick in only after fetal viability. So I think that's the argument. Obviously, this is something that's caught up in ongoing litigation, so I don't think we have a clear answer. But I think the idea is that the 1985 law banned abortion as far as legislators at the time felt they were able to, which was at viability. And that it wasn't intended to supersede more sweeping bans that had been introduced in the 19th century, but were kind of frozen in place as long as Roe v. Wade was the law.
We are answering why Wisconsin questions about abortion in Wisconsin in the 1800s, when our first laws came into effect soon after we became a state. Mary Ziegler with us, and Kimberly Riley, both professors who have studied these issues. Kim, you've written, I think, about how women in the 19th century understood abortion, might have thought about that. Can you give us some insight into what their mindsets might have been?
Sure. I think it's important for people today to think back and realize that there were no pregnancy tests in the 19th century. So if you no longer had your period, and particularly if we're talking about the mid-19th century, that might be because of any number of causes, right? You might have some sort of illness, you might have some sort of irregularity. And at a certain point, you might desire to restore your regular menstrual cycle. And that's the way that women often talked about it and discussed it. And that's the way that even in the late 19th century, after these bans passed, you see a lot of abortifacient medicines, basically these sort of non-regulated herbal compounds that would be marketed to women. They are described in terms of being able to regulate women's cycles or expel tumors from their uterus. And they use very coded language to basically advertise the fact that they can bring on menses when it stopped. But it's very clear from the language that they use that it's, you know, something that women understood to be either restoring their menses or potentially, you know, kind of precipitating a spontaneous miscarriage and abortion. So I think things were less clear cut, right, in the 19th century when we think about, you know, there's no little stick with a kind of, you know, plus sign on it that you can kind of hold up and say, yes, I'm pregnant. So I think that we have to think about those complications when we think about attitudes.
And staying with attitudes, Mary, can you talk a little bit about the, I guess, cultural mindset about behind the anti-abortion effort, the effort to pass laws in states around the country?
Well, I mean, unsurprisingly, it was complicated, right? So I think one of the listeners who wrote in suggested that the people who were trying to criminalize abortion, the doctors, had an investment in the idea that life began at conception. And we have some evidence, certainly they made that argument. That was a significant, at least, claim that they made and justification for their attitudes. They also made other arguments that I think would be less familiar to us today. They seemed concerned about the relative birth rates of Catholics and Protestants. So they were arguing that across the country, as Catholic immigration from states like Ireland increased, that that Catholic women were having more children than Protestant women, and that this was bad for the future of the country from a kind of eugenics standpoint. They made arguments about gender, essentially the idea being that women who were having abortions were kind of betraying their obligations to their husbands to have children and to be wives. And they even suggested that this was a sort of professional gatekeeping responsibility, because this was a time when the medical profession as a whole was much more kind of porous and less regulated than we're used to today. And I think this idea that only certain kinds of doctors understood when life began and only certain kinds of doctors had the moral fiber to oppose abortion was one point of differentiation in this very competitive market between doctors, midwives, and, you know, other kinds of homeopaths, other practitioners. So I think there were lots of motives that these activists seemed to have. So if you're trying to kind of pinpoint, you know, was it really all about fetal life, or was it really all about eugenics, or was it really all about gender roles? The answer seems to be yes to all of them. And I think sometimes it's hard to disentangle whether those things even, you know, were related internally.
And Kim, in our last minute or so, it can be tough to untangle our look at this history from the arguments we're having now in 2022. Is it possible, do you think, as we dig back into the history, to get a clear picture, given the biases we may all bring into it?
I mean, I think it is possible if we allow that the picture is probably more complicated than any of us, you know, would sort of imagine it to be when we come in with our present day biases. It's not a conversation of life versus choice in the 19th century. And I think if we can get beyond that and kind of open up to other possibilities, we might get a more accurate picture.
And briefly, Mary, is it important to do that?
I think so. I mean, I think it's important to understand our history. And it's also important to remember that history isn't sort of like an input-output machine. Mm-hmm. And often when we look at history, we're going to see messiness and nuance. So while I think it's important to understand kind of how we got where we are and where we are, I think it's also important to approach history from the standpoint of something that is going to be more complicated than kind of black and white debates we may want to have about a subject like abortion.
We'll leave it there. Mary, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Kim, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Mary Ziegler is a professor at the University of California Davis School of Law, a leading authority on the history of the abortion debate in the U.S., and Kimberly Riley is an associate professor of democracy and justice studies and history, chair of the history program, and co-chair of the Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies program at UW-Green Bay. They join us to answer listener questions submitted through WPR's Why Wisconsin project about views on abortion in the 19th century, when Wisconsin became a state and when original laws on the topic came into effect. If you have a Wisconsin-related question you'd like us to tackle, big or small, let us know. You can share your question online at WPR.org/Wisconsin. That's like W-H-Y-Sconsin. Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday, and we're talking about how to make our own pasta and pasta sauces from scratch, plus some delicious recipes, whether or not we're buying it at the store or making it at home. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.